Welcome to What is Going Om for New Thought from the Edge of Om. Each week on Om Time's flagship radio show, veteran broadcaster, author, and media consultant Sandy Sedgbeer conducts thought-provoking interviews with inspirational authors, artists, musicians, scientists, speakers, and filmmakers who are working at the point where spirituality and science meet consciousness at the very edge of Om. Here is your host, Sandy Sedgbeer.
Hello. We live in a world where nothing lasts. Everything we love, the relationships, places, and things we most count on, even as today's guest, something went wrong there with my internet just for a second. Let me start again. We live in a world where nothing lasts, and everything we love, the relationships, places, and things that we most count on, even our own bodies, will change or be lost. But as today's guest shows, the certainty of change and loss can actually support rather than diminish love. For at the heart of pain and loss is love. Matthew McKay, PhD, is a clinical psychologist and professor of psychology at the Wright Institute. He's also the founder of the Berkeley CBT Clinic and co-founder of the Bay Area Trauma Recovery Clinic, which serves low-income clients. He's authored and co-authored more than 40 books with tremendous success, including the Relaxation and Stress Reduction Workbook, Seeking Jordan, and The Luminous Landscape of the Afterlife. The publisher of New Harbinger Publications, Matthew McKay, joins me now to talk about his latest book, Love in the Time of Impermanence, which offers five ways to keep love alive in a world of impermanence. Matthew McKay, welcome.
Glad to be with you, Sandy.
You've written more than 40 books, but Seeking Jordan, The Luminous Landscape, and Love in the Time of Impermanence are quite different than your other titles. Tell us the story behind that.
Almost 15 years ago now, I lost my son, Jordan. And as I think any parent who loses a child feels, I wanted to know if he still existed, and I wanted to know if he was okay. And so I set out on a journey to find a way to communicate with him. And ultimately, I learned how to channel, and I learned that you can channel without any special skills or abilities. You don't have to be clairaudient. You don't have to be a medium. In fact, I've taught hundreds of people how to channel, particularly folks who are struggling with profound grief. And I've learned how to communicate to Jordan and have real conversations and ask questions and utilize the wisdom that he has as a soul who now remembers hundreds of lives and has all access to the wisdom of the spirit world. So he has, in many, in all of these books, has channeled a lot of material to me. And in the case of Love in the Time of Impermanence, this book we co-wrote together, has a lot of his thoughts and mine in combination. So I've been working with him now for years, and he wants to bring the wisdom that's available to him on the other side, in the spirit world, to the incarnate world, the world, the physical world that we live in.
Whose idea was it to produce this particular book on this specific topic, which is really badly needed right now?
Well, it was actually my idea, and Jordan, and the other books have been his idea, so it's sort of interesting in that way. It was my idea, but it was my idea because so much of what he's channeled to me, so much of what he's had to say has to do with love and the centrality of love in our lives, and also how vulnerable we are in this physical world to having the experience, at least, of losing love and losing it in different ways, losing relationships to hurt and rejection, and of course to physical death. And just the awareness of how everything changes in the physical world. And we are basically living a lifelong course in the school of impermanence here. And so he was very interested in getting involved. And so in this particular book, his all of his words are bracketed. So it's clear what in fact is coming from him.
Well, you know, as many of us know, we're living in a world where love seems to be becoming, you know, a commodity that is very rare on the planet. We see so much that is not love. And one of the things that you make very clear in your book is, you know, what love is and what love is not. So tell us a little bit about what love is.
You know, I'm glad you're asking, because it's so important to be clear about what love is not. Love is not a feeling. It's not an emotion. You know, we think about it, you know, the feeling of being in love as some overwhelming emotion that we all seek. But in fact, emotions come and go. And even when we're at the height of an in love experience, that emotion isn't there most of the time. And so love is not an emotion, a feeling. And it's not certainly a need or a dependency. And it's not sexual fidelity. It's not transient pleasure. It's just not any of those things. What is really apparent is that love is action. Love is enacted. It's not the feeling itself comes and goes, but the experience of loving is conveyed through what we do.
Yes.
And so this is through our daily decisions, even these small moments of choice all through our lives, all through our day. I could say this or I could say that. You know, how we respond to the people around us. Those are all small decisions and moments of choice that can be an opportunity to enact love or some sort of self-protection.
Yeah, love is a verb.
Yeah.
You would think, wouldn't you, that we've been around long enough, you know, that we would know what love is. Why is it that we have such a skewed idea of it?
Because it's so conflated with popular culture ideas about the feeling of love, romantic movies and books and stories and narratives. They're all about, you know, meeting someone and suddenly having this overwhelming feeling of connection, and that feeling determines everything and determines what we do and what happens in that relationship. And actually, nothing could be further than the truth. What determines our ability to love is our ability to act on love. And one of the things that I think is important is that love not only is an action, but it's a particular kind of action. First of all, it's caring, really caring about the well-being of whoever we love. And doing that in an active way, being aware of what would help and support that other. The second part of loving is knowing, is paying attention. It's seeing the other. It's seeing the beloved. It's seeing everything about the beloved, the pain, the hurt, the struggle, the needs, the hopes, the vulnerabilities, the fears, all of that. Is seeing and knowing, and it's constantly being updated. So when we love someone, we are constantly learning about them as they change and evolve. And that knowing and that seeing is an active part of an indispensable part of loving. And the third part of loving is compassion. It's seeing the other's pain and vulnerability, and caring about it and actively supporting the other to feel less pain. And so these are all very active experiences. And the final part of love is intention. It's the intention to every day and in every moment of choice to act on love toward whoever we love, whoever we care for.
Some people confuse love with self-sacrifice, but you say It can be an act of life, but it diminishes the one who loves. It depletes the soul.
If our idea of love is that I have to give up my own experience, my own needs, and that is the sort of the basis of loving someone else. I have to subsume what I need and what's going on for me to that other person. A sort of giving up of self. That's not really how love works. Now, sometimes we do, in our attempt to care for another, in our compassion for a beloved, focus on their needs, and that's a beautiful part of loving. But it doesn't mean abandoning the self, saying goodbye to awareness and care for ourselves. So I think some people think that when you love, that means you actually have to diminish your self-love,
yeah,
and self-care. Yeah. And that really is quite the opposite of what love is.
Mm. So how you talk about how we can keep love alive in the face of loss and disappointment and changes in our relationships. If somebody is no longer in our life, but we still love them, how can we act on that?
That's a really important question. And Jordan has a lot to say about that. Well, first of all, the relationship doesn't end because that person has transitioned out of this world and they are now in the spirit world. The relationship continues. The love continues. That person is just a thought away. So thinking of them and sending them love is an active way of continuing to have a vibrant living relationship with that soul. So when we think of that soul that's crossed over, that's in the afterlife, and we think of them with love, that is an active way of maintaining the relationship, and that gives them something. So the very act of thinking and remembering that soul is important. Sending them love is important. And from my point of view, communicating with them is important. Talking to them. And we can learn to listen to the telepathic messages they send us inside of our own awareness, inside of our own mind. So this is an active relationship, and it can continue to be. A lot of people think, well, that person's dead. It's over. I can't communicate. Even if they're somewhere in an afterlife, I can't, the relationship has ceased to exist, essentially. And that's just couldn't be further from the truth. And Jordan has been very clear about that with me. The relationships we have with our loved ones are absolutely inviolate. Death doesn't touch them, has no dominion whatsoever over the relationship and the love between souls.
Well, I want to get into this question of how we can communicate and, you know, telepathically and continue to have that relationship after the break. But one of the things I want to talk about is, you know, I observe a lot of people who have lost a loved one. And there is definitely a tinge of anger and resentment in their thoughts because that person is no longer there to support their needs, to give them that outlet that they need. And instead of thinking about them with love, they're thinking about them through that sense of what they've lost and, you know, the anger or the resentment or the lack of. So what would you say to somebody who is, you know, expressing in that way?
Well, you know, when we're in pain, we try to figure out, how did this happen to me? And the pain of loss is profound. And people will end up saying, well, you know, what caused this? Well, my loved one left me. My loved one died. Maybe they didn't take enough care of themselves, or somehow their death seems premature, and so we blame them somehow for the abandonment, for the hurt, for the pain that we're experiencing. And it's very understandable. But the problem is that we're seeing the relationship from the point of view of ego, my own needs, what my experience is, and from the pain that I'm suffering of loss. And part of the work then is to actually move our attention away from self to the beloved. What is it about them that I love? What is it about them that I've counted on? What beautiful qualities have supported and helped me? And as we focus on the beloved instead of on my own pain and loss, and start sending them love,
yeah,
the relationship reactivates. It's always been there, but it's latent, and now the relationship it reanimates, and I start to have contact, connection, and I can actually start getting nourishment from the beloved who's on the other side. So the main thing is to kind of move away from that immediate awareness of my own self and what's happening to me and my hurt and my loss, and bring my attention to the beloved and the things about them that are beloved, that I care so much for.
So this is what you mean when you talk about pain and loss being pathways to love.
Yeah, that's one of the ways.
Yeah. Why is there so much pain in this life? Has Jordan ever told you?
Yeah. He's very clear about that, that we come to this planet, and everybody who lives on this planet knows how hard it is, and how challenging it is. And in fact, you know, there are many, many, many planets where souls incarnate and learn. But this is one of the most difficult, one of the most challenging. It's sort of notorious in some ways among places souls incarnate. And so we have a lot of challenge and struggle here. We have physical pain. We have incredible emotional pain. And of course, we have the pain of impermanence, that we keep losing things that we count on that matter to us. So it's a very difficult place to live. But we come here to learn. That's what reincarnation is all about. We keep entering these lives to learn more and more and to continue to evolve as souls. Because as we evolve, since we are all God, we are all part of the divine, we are all part of collective consciousness. As we evolve, the divine God all evolves. And so we have a very sacred and important role here. Everything we learn and all of the pain that we struggle with and all that the pain teaches us. And one of the most important things it teaches us is how to love in the face of pain, how to love when things hurt. All of what we're learning is essentially uploaded and becomes part of the wisdom of the divine. So it's a very sacred mission, and that's why we're here. And the pain and difficulty in this place is part of our lesson plan. If this was an easy place to live, and there wouldn't be much to learn, and love would be easy, there wouldn't be a lot of pain. Let me give you an example, just kind of a simple example. So a mom comes home from work, her boss yelled at her, she's scared about her job, she's suffering from fatigue, anxiety, and her child has had a bad day, is actually struggling emotionally at this very moment, struggling with her homework, feeling discouraged. And somehow in the face of her exhaustion, her anxiety, and sense of overwhelm, she has to find a way to love that child. See, that's what we're doing here. We're loving in the face of pain. We're learning how to do that. It's easy to learn love in the spirit world. There's no obstacles. There's no pain. But here, it's an extraordinary challenge. You know, or an example. You know, let's say you know you're sitting down with your partner, and your partner has some very difficult things to say to you about unhappiness in the relationship. And suddenly up comes a lot of shame, and you feel like you're inadequate. There's something wrong with you.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you enact love at that moment when you're full of shame and all you want to do is hide or maybe get angry? And so we often are faced with these choices of you know, acting on our emotions and trying to protect ourselves from pain, or finding a way to love in the face of that pain. And that those are the lessons we're so deeply involved with here.
You know, as I said earlier, we are seeing a big lack of love, the absence of love in a lot of behavior that's going on worldwide right now. But also, you know, there's a lack of self-love. And you make a big point of talking about self-love and how we can learn to do that. I don't think that there is anybody on this planet who hasn't experienced lack of self-love at some point in their life. So what do you recommend to help people learn to cultivate that for themselves?
That was a wonderful question. I mean, in order, if I could just answer that question in a little bit of a roundabout way, what destroys love is one question. And as a couples therapist for more than 40 years, I've witnessed the death of love, the loss of love, many, many times with people. And it was one of the motivations for me to write the book. And what kills love is judgment. Judgment is what kills love. And so, you know, we get disappointed in our relationships, and we want things that we're not getting, and love acts in ways that are that are contrary to what we're hoping for or needing in the relationship, and we react to that pain with judgment. There's something wrong with them. They're bad. They're inadequate in some way, and oftentimes along with the judgment that goes anger. And it's that act of judgment that undermines love. And self-love is the same. It's when we judge ourselves, in this case, internalizing instead of external, in the case of getting mad at and judging one's beloved, one's partner, that's externalizing. That's making judgments of others. But self-love is deeply affected by internalizing self-judgment. I'm bad, there's something wrong with me. And so one of the things that we try to teach people to do is to be, it's a little meditation where they observe, you know, the sensations inside their body, and try to just observe the sensations and the feelings in their body without any judgment, just noticing what it is without evaluating it. And then noticing their thoughts, what kind of thoughts are going through, and trying to just observe the thoughts without evaluating. And as soon as judgment shows up, backing off from it and just watching the thought without judgment, then noticing their outside experience. What do they see, hear, and feel and touch in the world, and observing that without judgment. And finally noticing their emotions and just noticing what the kind of the tenor of their emotional life at this moment is inside. And even for a little while, how it might be changing or morphing. Into watching that without judgment. So we teach people how to watch their experiences. And when they have a judgment, notice a judgment and pull back from it, and learn the Tao or the spiritual discipline of observing without evaluating. And so that's one of the things we do. And then there's a lot of teaching self-compassion. Noticing my own pain, noticing what hurts, and having compassion for my pain, the compassion for the struggles that I live with, for the painful feelings that I experience, painful thoughts I have, the physical pain, to have compassion for how hard it is to live in these bodies on this planet. And so that's another thing we try to build. And then a third thing is self-care, how to care for oneself. And we have this whole process called the morning intention of, you know, each morning, how, you know, setting the intention of today, how am I going to love myself? How am I going to take care of myself today? In what specific ways I'm going to do that? And setting out each day with that intention. So self-love can be built with a series of practices but mostly what it does is it helps us climb out of judgment and into the seat of awareness, of just knowing, of seeing, of experiencing things as they are without judgment.
I'm glad you mentioned compassion, because as you were describing, you know, the judgment and the first part of that, I was thinking, well, you know, it's easy for us to be objective of others. It's not easy to be objective about ourselves. So how, you know, where do we actually begin to find that opening place where we can, you know, take that step back and be a little bit more objective of ourselves? And as you've said, compassion really is a great place to start, because we're not taught to have compassion for ourselves. We're taught that that is selfish.
Yeah, the biggest obstacle to self-compassion is our almost constant reflex to avoid pain. We don't want to think about our pain. We don't want to try to push the experience of pain away. We numb it. We drink it away. We, you know, do whatever we can to not feel pain. Well, if you don't have access to your pain, to your suffering, you can't be compassionate. Compassion is recognizing how the pain of the other. So if other compassions, we have to see the other and all their struggle and what they are going through. But we also, if we're going to have self-compassion, have to see our own pain and appreciate how hard it is to live here and how much we struggle and how much the obstacles that we keep facing in this life. Self-compassion, the doorway to self-compassion is the recognition of just how much pain we have and how difficult our life is.
Mm, yeah, yeah. We're always trying to transcend those things. You know, we don't sit with them and just acknowledge and say, yeah, you know, it really does suck.
A lot of us have a lifetime commitment to avoid awareness of pain. I don't want to feel that. Deliver me from it. Get away from that. But that same idea, I've got to get away from the pain, prevents me from having self-compassion, because I can't see my pain. I've blocked it.
Mm. I loved what you wrote when you said that, you know, behind every resistance, everything that we kind of reject, that we recoil from, that we don't like, there's a pain behind it. I'd never thought about it that way before.
Yeah, there. Everything we have an aversion to, we have some association of pain to that person, that object, that situation. And so one of the things that, you know, how do you love what you don't love? How do you love and embrace the things that are averse to you, that you have an aversion to?
Yeah.
And one of them is just noticing that you have an association of pain to that person or that object or situation, and then trying to experience them as they are. Yeah, okay, I've got this association, but how can I just notice this person or experience or situation as they are? Let me just take them in and see if I can experience them without the judgment. Because the pain creates a judgment, like,
yeah,
that's, you know, this was painful, so it's bad, stay away from it. Instead, it's like, let me just observe and be with this and notice and learn about this other. Even though I have some aversion, even though I have a history of pain in relationship, let me just observe and see if I can observe without judgment. See if I can just be with whatever I see and know about this other. The antidote here for aversion is knowing, is observing, is paying attention, and allowing ourselves to have as much awareness as possible about this other that we've had aversion to.
Mm. Yeah. We're going to take a short break now, Matt. You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and my guest today is Matthew Mackay, PhD, who is a clinical psychologist, professor of psychology at the Wright Institute, and a best-selling author. And we're talking about his latest book, Love in the Time of Impermanence. We'll be back with more from Matthew Mackay after the break.
OM Times TV. Imagine becoming a super influencer. Reinvent yourself, invest in your brand, and then manifest your success with a robust, spheric approach. OWN Times Media and Broadcasting offers a unique and multifaceted way to become the spiritual and conscious influencer you deserve to be by putting your message across our powerful platform with its proven record of integrity and excellence. Through our produced shows, OWN Times offers the opportunity to become a social media TV personality, a radio show host, an OWN Times Magazine columnist, and a syndicated podcaster, all in one shot. By live streaming your show on OWN Times TV and broadcasting it across the extensive OWN Times radio and TV networks, you become more than a host. You become an ambassador and a force for positive change. OWN Times. Open yourself to the possibilities.
Hello, I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, host of OWN Times' flagship radio show, What Is Going On? And as an author, editor, and 13 times book judge who's read thousands of books and interviewed hundreds of authors, I'm constantly asked, what's really worth reading and what's not? So I created the No BS Spiritual Book Club to help you save time and money by picking the brains of discerning names who have walked this path before you. There's no catch, no fees, and no BS. Just an ever-growing library of 10 best spiritual book lists from some of your favourite authors and teachers, plus free book excerpts, audios and video interviews with people like Don Miguel Ruiz Jr., David G., Lee Harris, Mark Nepo and more. From well-known classics to hidden gems you've never heard of, it's the only No BS guide to the best spiritual books to enlighten your journey of self-discovery. So why not join the club? Get inspired and save money at the No BS Spiritual Book Club.com.
There are 16 million children struggling with hunger in America. That's one in five daughters, sons, neighbors, and classmates who don't know where their next meal is coming from. Yet billions of pounds of good food go to waste every year. It's time we do something about it. Feeding America is a nationwide network of food banks that helps provide meals to millions of kids and families in need. Visit feedingamerica.org to help them feed even more. Together, we can solve hunger. Together, we're feeding America.
Welcome back. Matthew McKay, one of the things that I like about this book, which is really quite a short book, but it's really packs a punch because it has a lot of things that really made me stop and think. And I love it when that happens with a book because those are the moments where, you know, your perceptions shift and you have all your ahas. One of the things, you have a lot of meditations and practices and things that you offer in the book. And one of the things that really struck me when you were talking about your meditations to strengthen seeing, you said that when we project our ideals of beauty, appearance, and behavior onto a potential object of love, we erase the beloved and replace it with self. That really struck me. It really made me pause there because I'd never thought about it in that manner. But you're absolutely right. We are, you know, not seeing that person at all. What we're seeing is our projection.
And this is so often the case, you know, when we start to fall in love, is that we're sort of taking a button and sewing a vest on it in terms of this other person. We're making a lot of them up, and we're idealizing them. So we take our ideals, what we hope the best kind of human being could be, and we project it onto that person. And since loving depends on knowing, on seeing, authentic love requires us to be able to pay attention and see who this soul is, who this person is, independent of me and my projections. And the more I project, the more I obscure who they are, and the more difficult it becomes for me to have an authentic loving experience, because I'm really not seeing them.
Yeah.
So it is true that when we project, when we idealize, we actually prevent ourselves really from knowing the beloved.
I remember when I was writing a book once, interviewing a psychologist who said, the book was about relationships, and she said, never ever make a commitment in the first 2 years. She said, because you can guarantee it's all projection for those 2 years. And after that, you know, then you're in business. Yeah.
Yeah. It takes a while to get past that period of limerence. Yeah. Where there's, if it's just this wonderful excitement of being together. It takes a little while to get past that to actually see and know that person.
Yeah. And that's often the period where someone says, you've changed, when in fact it's not them that have changed at all, it's yourself. Yeah. So tell me about the meditations that you offer to strengthen seeing.
Well, I think the most important or most basic meditation that supports love is something called the morning intention. And I mean, we could even do it right now if you wanted, but what it involves is a very simple Vipassana meditation where we focus on the breath, pay attention to the breath, notice the in and the out of the breath. When thoughts arise, just bringing our attention back to the breath. And then after we settled in to a certain kind of inner quietness, we can form our morning intention. And the intention would be like this, would go like this. Today, at the moment of choice, I am love. Today, at the moment of choice, I am love. And what that means is, a moment of choice is like three things. When we feel a strong emotion, we feel strong desire, or we feel some pain, emotional or physical pain. When those things are happening, when or all of those things are happening, we're at a moment of choice, because the choice will be to act on the emotion, and oftentimes trying to avoid the emotion or get, you know, get that desire, have it, or to act on love. And so all throughout the day are moments of choice where we're having emotions, we're feeling experiences of pain, we have desire that pushes us towards something or away from something. And at every one of those moments of choice, usually they're occurring with other people, every one of those moments of choice is also a moment we need to be with them. And so today, at the moment of choice, I am love. And starting each day with that full intention and that I am love at all of those points where I could be something else. I could be acting on my desire or my pain or my feelings.
Yeah. That's probably, for most people, easier to do when you're among people that you care about. You have a meditation, the Tonglen meditation, which is a meditation that can help us relieve the suffering of others. And it can be used with several people. So how is that different? You know, is that something that we would find easier to have compassion for other people that we don't care about, that are strangers to us, if we did this particular meditation?
Well, Tonglen meditation is a very beautiful meditation, and it's kind of counterintuitive. In a Tonglen meditation, what you do is if the focus is on someone else, is just taking in that other person's vulnerability, their pain, their struggle, the things that are hard for them, and we literally breathe it into us ourselves. We visualize it in the meditation, breathing in their suffering as a kind of a dark cloud. We breathe it in into our heart area, and in that place, it's converted to kindness and love, and we breathe out kindness, light, and love to that other person. So we breathe in their suffering, it's a dark cloud. In our heart, it's transformed to light and love and kindness, and we breathe that out. And so it's a very simple breath meditation, but the intention behind it is to take their pain and turn it into love. To take their pain and turn it into love. So it's a compassion-based meditation. And, you know, usually we're trying to expel pain. We're trying to get rid of it. We're trying to, you know, run from it. And so that's why it's counterintuitive. We're actually taking in their pain, and we can have a Tonglen meditation for ourselves. Take in our own vulnerability, our own hurt, our fear, our struggle, our sadness. We did, you know, breathe that in again as the dark cloud in the heart is converted into kindness, love, and light, and breathe that out to ourselves. And so it's a very beautiful meditation, and it's very simple in some ways. You breathe in the cloud of pain, breathe out love and light, and it's something that you can learn to do pretty easily. But like all compassion, it requires us to recognize the pain of ourselves and others, and appreciate it, and to have an intention. You know, the Dalai Lama, you know, talks about pet compassion. It's the awareness of suffering and the intention to heal and do something about it. And so that's what the Tonglen meditation is. It's the awareness of suffering, bringing it in, breathing it in, and breathing out light and love, which is the intention to do something about it, to convert love and light.
We could certainly do with people in authority, in governments, Congress, in Parliament, you know, being taught some of these techniques. I know that Tim Ryan has been teaching some members of Congress meditation, but, you know, it ought to be mandatory, I think.
Yeah. Well, particularly compassion-based meditation, because Congress, I think, needs a little more compassion. But yes, meditation can be life-saving.
Yeah. So tell us about communication, how you teach people to communicate and have a relationship with somebody who has passed over, who's no longer with us.
Well, the first thing is something I mentioned previously, which is that these loved ones on the other side who are in the spirit world are just a thought away. As soon as we think about them, we actually start to open the channel. And we don't know that because we just think about them, and we're not necessarily listening telepathically for what they're saying to us. And we're not necessarily sending a message. But in fact, when we think about them, we begin to open the channel. So if people want to very deliberately engage in a conversation with loved ones on the other side, they can. It's kind of a simple process. Get something that connects you to that person. It could be something that they gave you or something that belonged to them. It doesn't have to be anything of any value. It's just something, some object that connects you to that loved one on the other side. Do something for eye fixation, like get a candle that just kind of holds the attention of your, you know, allows you to rest your eyes on something. And then just a very simple breath-based meditation begins to open the channel. Focus on your breath, and just for me, it's just I'll count each out breath. So the first out breath is one, and the second out breath is two. Continue to count up to 10, and then I may go through several rounds of 10 breaths, just focusing on the breath. And when thoughts come up, bring it back to the breath. When thoughts come up, bring your attention back to the breath. Very simple breath-focused meditation. And after a while, you begin to feel a kind of a quieting inside. And that's a moment where you can begin to really actively open the channel. And at this point, you can imagine an orb above your head, you know, maybe 6 inches above your head, color of the sun. Just imagine an orb up there, and then imagine it elongating into a long, long sun-colored tube that goes all the way to the loved one. That's the channel. You're just visualizing the opening of the channel. And while you're doing that, just be aware of how much you love the other, because the love of also is opening the channel. So you've done the little meditation, you've quieted, you have the intention to communicate, you visualize the channel opening with love. Then it's time to ask your first question. And I encourage people to write all of their communications down. I think it makes it easier. So literally write your question to that loved one, whatever it is. Are they okay? what's happening with them? What's the afterlife life like? What's going on up there? Or getting their advice, you know, about things that matter to us. They have a lot of wisdom. They have hundreds of lifetimes they've lived and have awareness of lessons of that we don't remember here. We have amnesia for all our past lives. They have lots of wisdom, so we can ask their advice. So ask your question. Literally watch yourself writing the question down. And that's a form of meditation, literally watching the words form on a page. And then wait. Allow your mind to open. And then the first word that shows up in your mind, write that down. It doesn't matter what it is. And wait. Wait for the next word or phrase. Write that down. And keep adding words and phrases till you have what feels like a sentence. Wait. See what comes next. And in the beginning, often it's sort of halting. But the flow becomes easier because you get used to it. And you just listen to the telepathic messages as they show up in your mind. And you'll notice that the messages are often in a form that is different from how you talk or think. It's really more in the form of your loved one and how they communicate and think, their style of communication. So you notice that what you're getting feels like it's distinct from you. It's not really your thoughts. It's coming from elsewhere. So just write down whatever the answers are. And when you're ready, when there's a pause, write the next question and wait and listen to the first word, the first phrases that come up telepathically. Write those down. So now you have a conversation that you're, and the writing of the conversation is really part of the meditation, part of the channeling and the opening of the channel. And also you have a record of the conversation. I have many, many hundreds of conversations with Jordan, and I have records for them. I like to go back and read them, even conversations we had years ago. So to keep a record can be really, really important because our loved ones have a lot of wisdom to give us. And also, you can learn about the afterlife if you want.
How did you feel the first time that you actually communicated with Jordan and knew that you were communicating with him?
It was kind of joyous. I mean, I had doubts like, is this really happening? I learned this from the late Ralph Messner, who was a kind of a specialist in after death communication. And I went home and did the practice just as I described it to you. And and I found myself getting telepathic communications from Jordan that felt they were quite distinct from me and how I think. And he was saying things that I had actually not occurred to me. There's new information, new ways of looking at things. And I was surprised by that. And his style of communicating was distinctly his own, not mine. And so I could feel the authenticity of it, even though I had doubts. And it was just joyous. I mean, for the first time I could talk to him I consulted mediums, but it was a one-way conversation. I was just hearing what the medium would understand. I did something called induced after-death communication, which is an extraordinary thing based on EMDR, that I heard him talking to me. But I was not able in any of these experiences to have a conversation and actually talk back and forth. And when he said something that made me curious, I could ask a question and he could follow up and say more. And it was just beautiful. So I guess I just want to acknowledge that it is something that people can do with loved ones, and it's not hard. But what it does is it maintains that beautiful, loving relationship. You can keep that. It didn't die when the person left this planet.
Mm. You did a process with Metzner, which was divination to your dying day, which you said is an extraordinary preparation for one's last hours and the dissolution of illusory boundaries between self and other. Why did you do that and what did you learn?
Well, one thing I learned is that as we approach death, there are a series of losses that was very sad. And I had to encounter that. I had to kind of get used to that idea. That at least for me, as I approached death, there would be a series of losses that would kind of limit what I can be and do in this world. And but what I also got, you know, I could see my moment of death, but I could also see, I could transition from there to the next life. And what I did experience was death is just a momentary transitional process. It's not enormous. I mean, to us it's enormous because we don't know what's beyond it. But I could see what was beyond it in the divination. And I could see how minor it is in the scheme of things, in the greater reality. It's simply moving from the physical to the non-physical to the spirit world. And in that movement, you know, this beautiful opening of light and love that is available to us, that here is obscured, and that we have amnesia for all of all that light and love that's in the spirit world. So it was both. I had to face the impermanence and the loss of my own powers and skills and the things that have mattered to me in this life. But I also could see beyond that, that death was a mere punctuation mark. It was just a moment in time that would allow me to usher into the greater reality.
It doesn't tell you when you're going to die.
Well, I had a pretty good idea of, I mean, of course, this is a projection from a certain moment in time, and I did this quite a number of years ago, but I had a pretty clear idea. And as Ralph said, you know, all the intervening circumstances and choices and things that I do could change that one way or the other. But I had a pretty good idea of how long I would live.
And that doesn't.
I'm not necessarily recommending this to people, by the way. I mean, it was something that I experienced. That the beauty of it was that I could see beyond death. That was the thing that meant a lot to me. And actually, there are other ways of doing that. You know, there's a whole process of it's called life between life hypnosis, and it's a hypnotherapy process where we move people into past lives, their immediate past life, move to their death in that past life, and then they can go to the life between lives, to the spirit world, and experience that. And I've done that with many people and help them have that experience, and that particular meditation hypnotic process was developed by Michael Newton, and anyway, it's a beautiful process, and I think that would be I would recommend that over going to one's death in this life. You know, go to the past life, move from your death in that past life into the life between lives, and experience that. One of the most important things you can experience in the life between lives, by the way, is your purpose for incarnating to this life. You know, why did you come here? What was your lesson plan? What were you trying to learn in this life? You chose a certain family, a certain body, a certain environment, a certain era and time and place. You know, what were you wanting to learn here? And so those are questions you can get answers to in life between life.
Would you say that you have fulfilled your plan?
Well, I would say I'm not so much fulfilled, but I think I'm engaged with the lesson plan. I'm learning the lessons I think I came here to learn. There may be more things that I have yet to face and experience, but I think I've learned a lot about loss and how to face loss, and there probably is more to learn. But I'm that's a big part of my own, I think, personal lesson plan and what I came here to encounter.
So one last question. Have you and Jordan decided what the next book is going to be?
Yes, he's working on it now. And I'm busy, you know, writing away what he has to say. This is a book, he calls it Soul Freedom. How to reach a place where you can actually make free will choices. Mm-hmm. And because free will choices are really very important to growth. You know, the purposes of coming to this planet is to grow, learn, and evolve. Being able to make choices that are not just automatic and habitual, but real free will choices, choices that we make authentically, is an important part of our growth. And so the whole book is about how to move toward the freedom to choose.
Wonderful. So where can people find you, Matt? I know that you have the website seekingjordan.com about the book, but is there any other place that people can interact with you or learn more about your work?
Well, if somebody wanted to reach me in particular, my email is matt@newharbinger.com. So if you felt like you needed to reach me, you can send me.
Okay. Matthew McKay, thank you so much. We've run out of time now. It's been a pleasure to talk with you. And Love in the Time of Impermanence by Matthew McKay is published by Park Street Press, a division of Inner Traditions International. That's it for this week. I will be back at the same time next week, but it will be 2 hours later than this. We're changing the time of the show to 9 a.m. I think that's a little bit easier on me and everyone else as well. So till then, it's goodbye from me. And thank you again to Matthew McKay.